We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life. Founder.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other will both get value from the episode.
So what does plucky mean to you?
So plucky, the word, came to me when I was messing around with the idea of starting my own business. So my backstory from right before plucky was that I was the director of employee development at a digital agency in New York. And I used to do a lot of phone screens, right, for potential hires. And one of the things I used to say on those phone screens was, listen, I am not in the business of hiring robots. I'm looking for full humans. And so I'm going to ask you some questions that might be non-traditional to other interview processes. So I'm thinking about that concept and thinking about, yeah, that really does underline a lot of what I believe about work and humans in work. And so it's actually, I had like thesaurus.com up and I was looking up the word robot because I thought, oh, maybe I could be like interesting with that, so like sort of subversive there or something. And one of the example sentences that they used to demonstrate the word robot was R2-D2, comma, the plucky little robot. And of course, they're talking about the little robot from Star Wars. And as soon as I read that, Sherry, I was like, plucky. Yeah, man, that's exactly how I feel. And so to me, like, of course, then I like ran home to my husband. We like went to look for URLs and like Warner Brothers owns plucky.com, I think, because of Plucky Duck from, you know, their cartoons. And I was like, damn it, I'll never have enough money to buy that. So then that's why we got beplucky.com. And I think it means to me grit and courage and not taking no, but like coming from a kind place too, and a reasonable place. And
yeah, there's a playfulness to it too. Because grit sounds, I mean, I love the word grit. I love the concept and the research behind it, but it sounds like it's like a little bit harsh. It's like gritty, but plucky has a little bit, there's a lightness and air to it that appeals to me as well.
It's kind of like one raised eyebrow.
Yes.
Kind of like, well, should we do this? You know, like that kind of feeling when a challenge comes, like, all right, is this what life is handing me? You know, like that sort of thing. And the ability to absorb something unexpected and to take it as it comes.
There's a little mischief.
Yeah, for sure.
I love it. So your work is, I mean, you do lots of things, but generally you're helping people figure out how to be successful together in their workplaces. So that can be managers to employees or CEOs to their people on their team. Like, how'd you start that? And why is it important to you to help people be successful together?
I think that maybe this is true for you too, but sometimes when you look back at what has been working for you on the planet since day one, like what kind of model have you been? What sort of role have you played? I was doing some heavy examination of that when I was thinking about starting my own business because I was going through postpartum depression with my first son. And it led me to ask these big questions like, why am I on the planet? What's my thing? Like what, if I were going to almost like audit my life and look back at what people keep coming to me, like towards me for, right? Not that I'm seeking it, but that it keeps showing up for me. What is that? And the thread that it all had in common was that I help people find their way. So whether that is like literally my siblings sometimes, or I was an RA in college and helped, you know, my freshman girls find their way. I saw this pattern that even when I was unsure of something, the way for me to like superpower through it was for me to then teach it and for me to turn around and somehow model is a strong word for it, but certainly mentor towards it. And so I realized that like, oh my gosh, people are coming to me to talk about their stuff, like literally online at Trader Joe's. All of a sudden there's somebody telling me about their divorce and I'm helping them through it, right? Like, why does this keep showing up? And I thought, well, there must be some sort of algorithm going on here, you know, whether that's DNA wise or learned, that I'm a good listener and that people are seeking me for this. So then the next obvious question became, why am I fighting that? Why does that not become how I monetize myself on the planet? Now, that obviously has a couple of paths. One is you could certainly stay in-house and do that for an organization, similar to what I was actually doing at the time. But there was also the opportunity, and I felt the market space, for me to be that for many folks and many companies. And I think I stayed in the workplace realm because obviously, you know, even how you just laid it out, a lot of what I'm talking about is how to handle humans, right? And how to handle yourself and know yourself. And there's lots of space for that in your personal life, but I feel like the work sphere really grounds the whole thing. At the end of the day, what you're trying to do is you're trying to do your best work. And the company at the end of the day is trying to get the best work done so that they can be the most successful. And so there's this kind of like really helpful bottom line of it all. Whereas with personal life stuff, I think sometimes it can be just so floaty and quicksandy. And you're the one in this conversation who has the mega degree in this stuff, but like, I didn't feel like I wanted to go back and become a therapist, but I also felt like that was maybe not my temperament either. I kind of wanted in those conversations to not necessarily look back, but to be like, all right, cool. F the past. What are we going to do now? You know? And I felt like it took me a couple of years to honestly own it, but I felt like coaching was really why I was here.
Like being someone who can find that alignment between how to get best work and how to get best work.
Yeah. And honestly, I mean, listen, let's fast forward 30 years. Maybe we're in a place where everybody is so gung-ho into self-care that they also have like their version of professional development budget, that each human has a personal development budget, right? That we become a society that embraces that in our homes and in our personal lives. But at this point, when I was thinking of starting Plucky, it was like, okay, well, that's going to be an even bigger pricing battle to convince people of. And so if you go to workplaces, they all have prof dev budgets, or many of them do, I should say, where they can start to apply it. So workplace, in the same way that the vertical of tech has money to throw around, they can be more experimental in these things. And so when you have an interesting new idea for a business, it's helpful to start in an industry where they're willing to take risks.
Absolutely. What are some of the conversations that you find yourself having over and over? Or I guess another way to ask that is, what are the core themes in your work?
Oh, man.
Confidence. I know that's a big question. But yeah. Okay, confidence.
Confidence. Nobody has it. Or it's really rare. When you find somebody who's confident, who knows who they are, that you should just hang out with them all the time. It's so refreshing, so beautiful. And I would say that not everybody has confidence in all areas of their life. That would be a super weirdo person. But like, I hear people need permission. People need recognition. And sometimes what they're asking me for is a masked version of that. So they think they're asking me advice about how do I manage this report? Or, oh my gosh, I now have a friend of mine who's on my team. How do I manage that? But really what they're asking is, how do I own this new identity? How do I feel brave enough to say hard things sometimes? And I have my own coach. I have my own version of those things, but I'm more than happy to be a mirror for those people to say, you already can. Right this second, you could do that hard thing.
So you do a lot of encouraging, prompting, yes, go out and do it. Give it a try.
Yeah. And also, I also have the other side of it where sometimes I will say, hold up, can I make an observation? And then I, you know, obviously the person's like, okay. And then I...
Right. Who's going to say no?
Exactly.
You could, no, you may not.
Right. So that's like a magic question. All of these listeners should steal that question. Can I make an observation? That's really magical. Take that to your one-on-ones because nobody's going to say no. And then you can sort of reduce it all. Like, here's a good example for me to say, can I make an observation? And they say yes. And I say, we have been talking about a problematic employee for over 6 months now. Why are we still talking about this? And I'm the person in their lives who is neutral enough and has no skin in the game who can say, do you actually know how much energy you're spending on trying to pretend this employee is still the right fit? And I will say that. Now, sometimes people are going to have a come to Jesus moment and be like, that's it. We're firing them tomorrow, right? And on another level, they might be saying, well, there's a lot of reasons for that. And that's fine too. And we can talk through those things. That to me is a signal they're not yet ready to leap. But at a minimum, I'm the person that's going to tell you that stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I think about confidence, and I know that you have a deep interest in adult development and just how we grow and thrive as humans at different points within our developmental lifetime. You know, when I think about confidence, I think there's this expectation that like once you're a grown up and you have a grown up job with a grown up salary that you should know what you're doing. And it sounds like you're observing that like a lot of people really don't. So how do you help grownups be grownups?
I just kind of come at them with the assumption that they are. And so much of the world is about doubting or asking, like, are you really sure you have the ability to do that? Are you really sure you went to the right school for that? Are you really sure this will be ready for you? Are you, you know, all that kind of question. And I just sort of say, like, yeah, okay, let's just assume it's a given that you can do that. So how do you do it then? And that is sometimes jarring enough for somebody to be like, wow, I didn't know there was even one person on the planet who thought that I could do it. You know, it's really refreshing to have somebody who is almost a perfect stranger to you, at least at first in a coaching situation, who's like, okay, cool. So that's where you want to go. Great. So what's the timeline on that? Instead of like, you're crazy. That's so risky. You know, you have children at home and you need a 401k and all those things are important. But you know, what's also important is not hating your life and not hating your job and bringing the best energy to your sphere. The inverse of what we were just talking about, where I help managers realize that they should, you know, just kind of be observing of how often they're talking about a specific employee, is the opposite of that. When I start saying like, can I just tell you that for the last 6 months, you have wondered whether this is the right job for you? Why are you still there? Right? So it's not only about firing someone. Sometimes it's about quitting a job. And man, if I, especially lately, I feel like 80% of the people I'm talking to should not be in this job anymore. And for scared reasons, they stay. And I really think the whole planet is ready for everybody to have a better situation than they have right now.
One of the things that I have found a lot in my work lately is almost the overextension of adulthood. And I've been talking with a lot of people about the importance of play and their own giving themselves permission to be lighthearted, to not have to hold up the weight of the world, to not have to, you know, think about the well-being of each one of their employees all the time at every moment of the day, but to really return to some of those earlier life experiences of joy and being frivolous and splashing in the lake and, you know, really relearning how to play. Is that something that you're seeing as well? Or
it is. I wonder how do you do that? I'm so curious. Like you yourself.
Me personally?
Yeah.
I'm an excellent player, actually.
Yes. What a player.
Yeah. So I mean, there are a couple things that I love to do for play. One is aerial yoga.
Whoa.
Like flying around on the ceiling, like suspended from the ceiling in a piece of fabric. And then because I have kids, I get lots of excuses to like eat ice cream and ride a bike and throw rocks in the lake and build cool things with Legos. And I have, you know, a great circle of friends that like to play too. So we'll rent a boat and go up the river. So I think for me, a lot of play is being outside and a lot of it is in motion and a lot of it is with people I love. But it's definitely not like time invested in the outcome of some project. It's time spent purely for the joy of whatever it is in that moment.
I resonate a lot with that too. I think I see, like, even to your point, folks that have kids at home or have like a sort of societal excuse to go to children's museums and things like that, they have a better handle on those things. I think play is hard because we think we're supposed to be done with that and we're not. And I can't tell you how many times I've had the experience where I've been coaching somebody for a while. We talk mostly about work stuff, but sometimes we talk about outside of work stuff. And like, I don't know, 4 months in, 2 months in, whatever it is, all of a sudden I'll be like, oh, it's too bad you don't have something to do this weekend that's like totally different than your day job. And then the person will drop like, well, I've never mentioned it, but I actually go to circus school on the side.
And I'm like, yes.
What? Or like a couple months ago, there was like, well, I actually haven't mentioned this, but all day on Sundays, I go to ballet. This is like an engineer who on Sundays goes to ballet. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You're like killing me right now. The metaphors in that are so ripe, you know, like that we are almost like, we never lead with anything like that. We lead with what our job is or
our qualifications, our title,
where we went to business school, like all that. But it's not also like, and on the side, I'm learning how to be an acrobat.
Right.
That, who doesn't want to have dinner with that person? That person is amazing.
What do you think would happen in workplaces if we led with that more?
Oh, I think people would see you as a 3D person and not just a resource with billable hours. And, you know, that's not to demonize that because it's really important for businesses to know that they're getting value out of people. but also to, you know, this is like a nice segue into this concept of adult development, which is what I feel is my mission on the planet, to empower that concept of adult development via workplaces, but really overall, is that as a company, you can ignore the fact that someone just lost their parent, or you can make space for that. And if you make space for that, not only are they going to be able to fumble less through the work, but they will also be retained for way longer because they will know that it is not just a company, it is a community of sorts. And the levels of burnout would be different. The thing is, and you know, maybe this is for your work as well, but sometimes I feel like my actual job is to be a permission slip in a room for people. So when I go and do an annual retreat with people, I teach workshops or I teach a manager training, whatever it is, I'm the one saying like, hey guys, what's the crazy thing you do on Saturdays that you have never told most of your coworkers? And then because I've prompted that, it comes out and then you can feel the whole room like gel a little bit, like go from a state of matter, you know, go a little bit more ethereal, like
a little more plasma.
Yeah.
It's a little looser, more yes. mobile.
And unfortunately, and understandably maybe, you know, companies have a hard time doing that on their own. It is really different if like your CEO shows up and says, hey guys, what are you doing when you play? And, like sometimes that's not the right messenger for that.
And sure, so absolutely.
Sometimes you need someone who's a little bit off, not on payroll to come in.
Who's a disruptor.
There you go. Very startup of you. Yes. Totally.
Yeah. I feel like in some ways the nature of work and workplaces is being maybe a little bit in crisis. Like on one hand, I think people are longing for belonging and that workplace in some ways has replaced traditional tribes or like extended family networks, your church community, your bowling league. I mean, the place where you generate a lot of your relationships for many of us is in our work. And so as adults, we're like needing more connection and level of community at work than perhaps we have in the past. But at the same time, I think many workplaces are really expecting more and more in terms of production and being on Slack and availability. And so it's both this need for more humanizing communities and also demand for productivity that maybe exceeds what it's been in the past.
Man, I think that can feel really depressing.
Yeah.
Like when you really start to dig into it and you really start to think about it. And my guidance for anybody listening to that who's like, oh God, they're so right. The whole thing is, you know, going to hell in a handbasket. Like my guidance there is to, honestly, this is what I do on a federal level every day. When I wake up and I see the news and it's really hard and it's really just unbelievable some days, I go immediately to local. So I'm like, okay, I can't think about the entire country that I live in, but I can think about the people I pass on the way to walking my kids to daycare and saying good morning and smiling. And that's what I would say to any person listening to this too. If you're feeling like the beast, the machine that you work for, the, you know, damn the man, whatever, wherever you are, if that's too big to fix right now, which it is, by the way, always, if that's too big to fix, then you just need to worry about the person that sits to the left of you and to the right of you, and the person who's showing up on your next phone call. And you just start there and you just bring your 3D version to those people. And then it starts to spread. And that is like really all you have to worry about, like to the left and to the right. And if everybody did that, we'd be super golden. So
right, we would be okay.
Yeah, it would be a huge chain of really open, kind, empathetic people who still all really want to succeed. Because that's the other thing I'll say, Sherry, is that like, I don't think I have ever coached or met or encountered a truly lazy person in the industry I work in. They are all really trying. So this push towards like productivity and production and whatever, you're already getting a really good cut of the world. Like you're already getting people who are high achievers, high performers, ambitious, dedicated, and loyal. So let's not abuse the hell out of them. Let's recognize that they're already in a really great spot and then polish maybe a little bit, but nobody needs a deep clean from what I've seen. Everybody is already having enough imposter syndrome and doubt of if they're doing enough. And the answer is always you're doing too much.
More is right than is wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So thinking a little bit about you know, that transition from general global to specific. And just thinking about the little that I know of your life and what you've shared even about how you came to this work, and that you've had some really specific low points in your life, like your struggle with postpartum depression, and also in the last couple of years, battling a brain tumor and having, you know, a big surgery and a big life shift. How has that shaped you as a human?
I have to say, it is also just still so surreal to know that the content of a podcast that I'm on is about a brain tumor. Like, I realize it's been 2 years, but it is still so bizarro that now I'm the person that people call from neurology offices to say that they too have a brain tumor. Or like, it's weird, you know, sometimes life,
it's this new identifier, like a new identity that's been attached to you that you didn't go out and fight for, you didn't seek, but is now sort of is a trace behind you now, probably for the rest of your life to some extent.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, you're part of this alumni group you never even knew you applied to, you know? So yeah, the general story is that I had my second son in July of 2015, and we were on the lookout for postpartum depression because, like I said, for my first son, I had had it. And there were a number of symptoms, but it didn't seem to really add up to postpartum. It was like super fatigue, just really feeling off. And everybody, the GPs, I would keep going back. Honestly, it was probably every week at some point. And the GPs would say, listen, you're stressed, you run a business, you're a young mom with two kids, that's what it is. So then, you know, that's really hard. You're like, okay, stop being stressed. So you go, you pursue acupuncture. I had a therapist, I tried to work out, all these things, but really there was still something not well. And I was having headaches and they were like, just take some Advil. And at a certain point I said, listen, I'm taking Advil every afternoon, like four pills at a time. That is not normal. And so there were all these random symptoms, but there was nothing that cohesed them into a story. And at a certain point I saw a neurologist, which was really kind of random in itself. And he was like, I think it's nothing, but let's just have you have an MRI. So that was April of 2016, 2 years ago. And it was obviously the biggest shock of my life to get home and 10 minutes later have this neurologist call me and say, I need to tell you some big news. Like, you have a brain tumor and it's really big. It's the size of a lemon and it's pushing on your left eye and you're probably having little seizures and you need to have brain surgery like within a couple weeks. And I had to wean my baby within 4 days because I immediately got an anti-seizure meds and all kinds of stuff. And my husband got like, you know, jumped in a cab, came right home.
It's an emergency. It becomes a crisis. Yes. That happens in one phone call.
Yep. And there's this feeling of like, not now. Come on, man. Not now. Like, I have this baby. I have these two beautiful sons. Like, I've also been building this business. This is all working. Just back from maternity leave, you know, these sorts of things. And the truth was, there was no not now option. That was when it was. And so it was awful. And it was probably honestly the most defining moment of my life, because the work that I needed to do all went away. It was like, I immediately, you know, I called all my clients that weekend and told them, listen, I don't know when I'll be able to get back, but I'm not, you know, we're done for the moment. And everybody was shocked too. You know, I'm like 35 years old. It's a really crazy story, but somehow I learned to ask for help in that process. I also learned that you can have really, really great spreadsheets and plans, and sometimes it doesn't matter. And so there's a more lightheartedness that I bring to it. Like, okay, well, that sounds like a great plan, strategy doc. Maybe it will happen, but it could also not. And if it doesn't, that doesn't mean that the work wasn't worth it, or, you know, all these sorts of things. And I had surgery about 2.5 weeks later. They got it all. It was benign. And the repercussions are pretty limited at this point. I do still have seizures, but they're really teeny and I don't lose consciousness or anything. And I don't need to be on meds yet for that. So that's great. But I don't know, you know, sometimes, like, I always felt like I wanted to write a book. I'm a writer. So I always wanted to write a book and I never really knew what that book should be about. And I sometimes joke to people that maybe I was just waiting for the content to show up. And then I got some really big content. So I would say it's not at all on a front burner right now, but I do have a draft of a memoir that I wrote last year about it. And it's called I Believe in Everything. And it's because I do. I really think every single thing, like to your metaphor about play, I think every single day and every single moment is an opportunity to use the experience as a playground of sorts, to like jump on it, but also mess with it, but also not take it too seriously. And the people who are able to do that, I find they are very resilient and able to navigate almost anything. So even though you know the uncontrollable at some point will show up in your life, you're ready as best you can be.
It's been an interesting experience for me to come into corporate business world after years of being a trauma psychologist and talking, you know, with people somewhat like your experience, where there've been these really extreme life or death moments, like this moment where it looked really unclear whether you were going to survive. And for me, it's kind of brought this lightness to it, which is, I guess, maybe a little bit counterintuitive, but it's a little bit like, hey, this is all a game. Like, this is all play. Like, every moment you get is a bonus, because there are a million reasons or moments where you could have easily not been here. And that it doesn't make me sad. It doesn't feel like a burden, but it is this sort of existential reality of how finite our time is and how much every moment really is like, hey, lucky you, you got another day.
You know what's interesting, Sherry? I have been thinking about this lately, but I haven't talked to anybody else about it. I have been thinking lately, so I'm 37 and I am, you know, aware of the last, I don't know, 10 plus years of my life. I have known people trying to get pregnant, right? Friends or whoever else, people in my life and community. And I know a huge portion of that who has struggled with fertility, right? And I think this is on the lips of a lot of people today. There's a lot of new resources out there, IVF and all these kinds of things. And when you really think about it, this is like my most woo-woo self, but when you really think about it, the odds of you existing are really tiny. Like the sperm and the egg whole scenario, we don't have to do birds and the bees on this podcast right now, but like,
we've talked about it before.
Okay, great. So welcome back to the sex ed section. But you know, like, that is so infinitesimal. And when I watch friends of mine who finally end up with the joy, the lucky ones of bringing a baby into their lives, biologically, they are so grateful. And I wonder what it would be like if all of us could feel that. That question I asked earlier about, like, why am I on the planet? I wasn't yet thinking about it from that context, but it is still a deep question of, like, I don't know, religious or not, you don't really have to necessarily even trace this back to some larger power if you don't believe in that. But the odds and the math behind it are really, like, slim that you got here. So now that you're here, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing with your time? It's really super big question. And a lot of people are afraid to think about it. But I don't know, I felt like recently I've been thinking about that new sort of doorway to the question, which is maybe a lot of us also know people that really want to become parents and want to bring a human here. And that we are all obviously here because someone else wanted that.
Yeah. And I think when we encounter near death, or, you know, I'm a couple years older than you, but slowly starting to get to the point where my friends are losing their parents. I had a couple of really close friends in the last year lose parents, and my own parents have had really, really serious health issues. And so we're at this, you know, talk about coming full circle to adulting. Like, we're at this moment where, like, there's no, like, the people who brought us to the planet are soon not going to be here anymore. And we are the ones who are then sort of holding the mantle for the people that come behind us, which is, of course, this sort of core of adult development is, as we get into middle and late adulthood, according to Erickson, we're talking about generativity. What are you creating that's going to outlast you and stay? And what are you making in the world that brings you joy, but also is greater than you? And I think that's, whether it's work or home or not, those are the questions that are good to ask. Maybe we can't live there every moment of the day, but certainly deepen our lives and deepen our sense that I'm choosing this. I'm intentionally showing up in my life in this way because my time's limited and this is how I'm choosing to spend it today.
My parents are both healthy. I feel really lucky for that. But yes, for sure, at some point that will be a bridge that I cross too. And I feel so sad even just thinking about it. But you know, Sherry, you and I met in person finally after many years of hearing about each other, but we finally met in person at this Elevate Leaders Conference a few weeks ago. And I gave a talk there called The Grownups Are Not Coming. And that was specifically to sort of ignite in each of us this concept that, like, you got to fly, little bird.
Yeah. This is your time.
Yeah. And whether it is that the dauntingness of bringing home a new baby and being responsible for the next 18 years for this human, if not beyond, or firing someone for the first time, or honestly processing a diagnosis, like, whatever it is, that was another moment. I didn't talk about this at the conference, but man, when I went into that neurologist for the first time, the day when they called and I saw the image, MRI image of my brain and this huge tumor in there, that was a moment where I was like, where are my parents? Like, where are the grownups? Yeah. Who's coming to talk to this doctor? Cause he's saying a lot of big words and I don't know what that means. And I also have kids at daycare. What does that mean? Where are they going to go? Like, whew, like that is a huge, when are the grownups coming? And so I like thinking about this, not as a rejection of our parents, not to say my parents are nothing, I have to stand on my own. It's not that. It's more just stepping into your next lineage. It's stepping into the fact that you stood on the shoulders of giants and now you have to be a giant for new people and also for yourself. And the whole concept of, you know, I think we're kind of messed up at this point with like helping and loving old people because they're so wise and I love them so much. And I used to be a waitress at a retirement home when I was in high school and those people were like some of my favorite people and they have just lived so much more. The day after the election, I saw an older guy sitting at a cafe and I asked him, I was like, hey, how are you doing? Did you ever know a time like this in America? And he was like, never. I was like, okay, that's so depressing. I need to leave right now.
Yeah, and then, okay, we can continue this conversation.
he was like, I'm 92. And I was like, all right, now we're done. I'm going to go to the bar now. Like, but all that to say that I think there is inherent wisdom that all of us are gathering all along the way. And that instead of waiting until you're 80 to believe you have it, you could start believing it right now.
Because the world needs you now.
Yeah.
And the person to the left and the right, right? The world sounds too big, but the person to the left, the person to the right. I'm quoting you back to you, Jen. they need you now. So.
Yep. I love my work. I love my career. I see myself very much as a career person. I also love being a mom, but that is a different role for me. And I'm home with my kids 2 days a week. And some days, including yesterday, are harder than others. But I had this realization a couple of weeks ago that every single client I have, I'm obviously trying to help evolve and transform and fingers crossed, they're going to make great, brave choices and live their best life. Right. But I kind of forgot that the biggest influence I have is over the two little boys that live in my house. It is non-billable work, but that is the reality that the biggest influence I have could be over the two of them. And boy, did that bring some real focus for our Tuesdays and Thursdays at home. I was much more grateful for it lately. And, you know, everybody makes a schedule that works best for their family. But I really realized, like, oh, let's not forget about those people you're influencing when you're so excited to do this career level work. You know, that is real deal. Like, have these babies and raise them to be strong men and open men and fantastic, just, you know, people that believe in themselves. That feels like almost the most efficient work I could do.
Yeah, it's your own really deep, profound contribution to the world. And they are who they are, right? They are not extensions of us, but like your level of caring for them and your level of like what you let them see in the world, how you introduce them to this life is such a profound contribution. I remember like kind of wavering on whether I wanted to have kids. And I had this conversation with a friend and I had one of those aha moments where I was like, you know what? My decision to have children is because it's like my ultimate stamp of hope. Like I feel like I want to give a little piece of something better to the world. And I'm hopeful about the future and humanity. And again, I'm a big picture kind of existential thinker. So, you know, I'm doubling down. Like I'm leaving my DNA for the next generation, better or worse.
Yeah. I mean, like even this loops back to that concept of confidence. I really think the number one thing I could give my kids is confidence to empower that in them, to help them find it. They are 2 and 5 right now. My 2-year-old does not need this lesson. He has a lot of confidence right now. he knows he is always right. But my 5-year-old struggles with that, and he's a pretty sensitive guy. And he started taking the sports class on Saturdays. And I noticed that when the teacher commends him, he loves class. But if the teacher's distracted and doesn't see him take the basketball shot, or the teacher doesn't happen to say, like, good job, Noah, he will get upset almost. And like, he really needs that permission and that reward. And it's very meta. You probably feel this in your work too, where all the adults I'm coaching, I'm like, oh gosh, like how do I prep my kid to like surf this a little easier if possible? And obviously you cannot protect them from all these things, but I made up a game with Noah on the way home from class that day that I opened the sunroof in our car and I was like, okay, we're going to play a game. You have to yell so loud that it will go out of the sunroof, and you have to yell something you know about yourself that's really tough. So like, I was like, I'll go first. I was like, I'm Jen and I know that I am really smart. And then he was like, okay, I'm Noah and I know that I try really hard. And then we just did it back and forth the whole drive home, like 15-minute home. And it was so fun and also like important. It felt like it was powerful to hear his voice get stronger so that it could get out of the sunroof. And I was like, man, every adult should do this every day on their way to work. Like, that would be amazing, right?
That's your homework, exactly. Listeners. Open the sunroof.
Yell it out. Yeah, own your stuff. Be confident. Totally.
Oh, Jen, it has been such a delight to spend this time with you. And thank you for making time in your day and your schedule and all the things you've got going on. And we'll link to your website in the show notes. But if there are people who are like, oh my gosh, I love this Jen lady, and they want to follow you or learn about what you're doing, what's the best way for people to get in touch?
So yeah, going to my website is great. I probably should update that with places I'll be speaking. So you should come and hear me speak. You should come to my new manager training. It's called So Now You're a Manager. And it's for people who've been managing for 5 years or less and who need to have some help finding their way, finding their leadership voice. It's really good and fun. So I would love to spend 2 days with anybody who wants to come and join us.
And that's in Oakland?
The next one is in Oakland in June. And the next one is in Dayton, Ohio in August. So right. I like to move around the country because I think people need good managers everywhere.
Absolutely. Well, fantastic. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sherry. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.